This hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by MM Comfort Systems. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? The homelessness crisis.
Some more controversy out of Mercer Island, all because of their vote to expand their ban on homeless camping on public property. Before, it was just in parks, and now they decided to ban it on city-owned property all across the island. They did this because they have been having some problems with prolific offenders, for lack of a better term, in that you've got a core group of about 10 to 12, according to officials, of folks who continuously will camp out, homeless camp out, and not take up the city on their offers to get them to nearby shelters. There's one in Bellevue. There's another one in Kirkland. Those are the closest ones. Mercer Island doesn't have any on the island. And they keep saying no, and they keep showing up. And folks who live on the island are concerned, and they should be, not just because no one should have to have a whole bunch of homeless people taking over parks that they are trying to enjoy, but because they live right next door to Seattle, which has become a third world country in some ways in these parks. Like if these individual parks and individual parts of Seattle, like in Pioneer Square and SoDo and downtown and parts of Belltown and parts of Capitol Hill, if they were their own countries, they would be third world countries. The amount of misery that's on display, it is shocking. And the city, of course, here doesn't do anything about it. They let people live in squalor and filth without helping when they could help, but they choose not to. And so folks in Mercer Island, on Mercer Island, they don't want that to happen there. And so they have instituted this policy that officially says, hey, we will get you room at a nearby shelter. We'll take you there. And if you don't, and you continue to violate the law, you can see up to 90 days in jail or $1,000 fine. Now, of course, they're not going to be able to pay the fine, but they're hoping that this is just a way to disincentivize the homeless from continuing to come there. Whether or not it's going to be effective doesn't matter. Because for them, they're just trying to do something and see what the reaction is. And if it's ineffective, then they do something else. Now, the controversy, I guess, if you want to call it that, is that the two shelters that are nearby say they were never consulted about the plan before Mercer Island went through with this. Now, I'm not sure that matters per se, but David Bowling is the executive director of Congregations for the Homeless. This is in Bellevue. And as of right now, he says, look, we don't have room for anyone from Mercer Island.
We're turning away an average of about five or six men each night. I wish Mercer Island would have reached out to us.
I don't know why they would reach out to you. Because if you don't have the room, then they're not going to bring the homeless folks there. Presumably, they're going to make a phone call before they drop someone off there. Because then, if they didn't do that, then the city of Mercer Island would be in some potential legal problems. Alisa Chetinsky, talking to Como TV, is the executive director of the Sophia Way. It's the organization that runs Helen's Place in Kirkland. Says they would have been open to a conversation about this with the Mercer Island City Council.
It would have been nice if we were told about this ahead of time and asked to talk about it.
What would you talk about? What would you say? Because again, they're not going to turn down folks who are in need of help if they have open beds. They're not going to do that. But she doesn't like the plan out of Mercer Island.
It sounds very arrogant to me.
Oh, does it, their plan? So then why would they talk to you about it? Your job is supposed to be to help people who are living out on the streets, give them some shelter. Okay, do your job. Mercer Island's job on the council is to be the voice of the people. It's really that simple. Because, as she points out, she's always going to welcome the homeless.
If we have room, we will never turn anyone away.
So then why do we have to come to you for anything? This is literally your job. This is literally your job. The reason why people are complaining about this, the ones who are, and it is a small group of people that are amplified in their voice, are the ones who generally are responsible for the homeless situation getting as out of control as it has become. People who seem perfectly content allowing folks to live out on the streets rather than getting them into shelter. And those are the exact kinds of voices that we need to stop listening to because they've been in charge for so long, not just in Seattle, in Olympia, in Bellingham. We've seen how some of those activists have caused problems in Fife, in Tacoma, in Puyallup. And so the folks over at Mercer Island are doing what they should be doing. They're doing what you should be doing, regardless of where you live. Maybe you're in Covington or Kent. Maybe you live in Milton, the gem of Pierce County. Kenmore. Bainbridge Island. Wherever. You need to start taking a more proactive approach before you become Seattle. Because bad policies of Seattle spread and the bad activists, their ideas, the ones who are hardcore ideologues, they inspire other hardcore ideologues around the region. It starts in Seattle, and then before you know it, it hits Olympia. Look at some of the parks in Olympia. Look at the homelessness there. Look at the situation with the encampments around City Hall in Bellingham. And so tell me, if that's what you want to have happen in your community in Graham or Ording or Woodinville or Bothell. And if the answer is no, then you need to start being proactive like they're doing out on Mercer Island. Especially when you're a smaller community like Mercer Island and you don't have the resources that Seattle does or an Everett or even a Tacoma has. Because all it takes, on, especially in these small and mid-sized cities, is just a small group of activists to scare a council into action. And so you guys need to step up and start inspiring. Now, Bowling, again, the executive director of the shelter on in Bellevue, understands that he didn't have to be. He didn't have to be consulted. Now, should he have been? Como TV asked Mercer Island Mayor Benson. Benson Wong.
I'm not sure if I'm in a position to comment on that.
Yes, you are. You are in a position to comment. You are choosing, sir, not to comment. That is on you. But yes, you could actually comment if you so choose. You are the mayor. I love that. I'm choosing. I don't know if I should comment. You should. You don't know? You should do it anyway. Just do it anyway. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to join the conversation. 1-800-465-8770. Send me a text message. Don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JasonRants. I will be on Tucker Carlson later this evening, the video of which will be available at my Twitter feed, twitter.com/JasonRants. I'll be talking about Seattle schools having radical BLM anti-police agendas being taught in the classroom. So don't forget to watch that. Twitter.com/JasonRants. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? You can't make this up.
So you can't make this one up. Now bike helmet laws are racist. That is the implication in a Seattle Times piece talking about the disproportionality. Remember, anytime anyone cites anything talking about disproportionalities or disparities without giving you the context of the why, there is an agenda. And right here, you can already tell from the title that it's going to be agenda-driven. Racial disparities prompt calls to repeal King County's bicycle helmet law. It's written by Michelle Barockman. And it starts off having literally nothing whatsoever to do with the issue other than to say that they are going to frame this as a story about racism, about bigotry. It says, in the fall of 2019, a white man spat on Edwin Lindo while he was riding his bicycle with a friend around Mercer Island. It gets on my jersey, and I'm like, I can't believe this is happening right now, he recalled. Lindo, who identifies as Central American indigenous from Nicaragua and El Salvador. Is he or is he not that? And his friend, Aaron Bossett, who is black, doesn't identify as black, he is black, viewed the encounter as a racist attempt to exclude them from the biking community. Now, right then and there, does that make sense to you? It might have been inspired by racism, just randomly, I'm assuming, spitting on this guy. Okay, go with it being racist. There's no proof that this happened to have been racist, but okay, fine. Let's just assume that that was racist. It's certainly not something that happens every day. What does that have to do with bicycling? Why does that have anything to do with it? So if you're a racist and you feel compelled to spit on someone, wouldn't it be because you just simply are a racist and it has nothing to do with bicycling? It has nothing to do with bicycling. However, they do this, they use this anecdote right at the beginning because it can help them frame the story that bicycle helmet laws are racist, which is what this is actually about. It says Lindo has joined a chorus of individuals and organizations calling for the repeal of the King County law that requires bicyclists to wear helmets because of a, wait for it, disproportionate enforcement, especially among black, native, and homeless riders. Lindo, who wears a helmet when he rides, who started the biking group North Star Cycling Club, said, folks aren't riding around without helmets because it's fun. They're doing it because helmets aren't cheap. Buy them a helmet and you won't have to penalize them. So now it's, if you're going to have a law that's supposed to enforce safety and help with general sort of PR for a city and a community, in this case a county, because if a whole bunch of people are getting hurt walking, biking, driving, taking the bus, or whatever, it's bad PR effectively, and it can cost the city and county money. You now have to cover, subsidize the services or the products that keep people safe. I can't afford a car. Buy me a car with a seatbelt if you're going to have seatbelt laws. Medical experts are out there, and they've been saying the same thing for a long time, despite some in the militant bicycling community that want to pretend that simply more bicyclists mean that it's safer to bicycle without a helmet, which is a disingenuous way of interpreting the data. People who are against wearing bicycles, helmets, will say that it's safer. All you have to do is have more bicyclists there. And the reason why they take that position is that when there are larger groups of bicyclists together, cars are more aware of the bicyclists. They tend to drive more safely or slowly so that they don't actually hit the individual who's bicycling, and thus there are less serious injuries. What, of course, they don't tell you is that if there are 50 bicyclists who are going down a steep hill on a wet day, they hit a rock and they fall and they hit their head, they will likely die or be seriously injured the same way as if there was just one person who was around them while they were bicycling and zero cars. And medical experts say that. In fact, they say this in the piece. Dr. Frederick Rivara, who's a professor of pediatrics over at the UW School of Medicine. The data are very clear. Helmets prevent brain injury. All should be protected. But there's disproportionality. Now, they're only looking at 1,667 helmet citations over the course of almost two decades. Between 2003 and 2020, found that black cyclists received helmet infractions at a rate nearly four times higher than white cyclists. Now, they're looking at it as a percentage of their demographic. They're not looking at the raw number, because the raw number is overwhelmingly white. In fact, it's very, very close, even in the representation for the white folks. But because, remember, it's all about disproportionality arguments, the laziest argument you can make, they immediately infer that there's some kind of racism here. They don't have to prove it. They just have to look at the data. They don't have to say why. They don't even ask why. They just say, look, it's different. Hashtag equity. So when you look at the white demographic of bicyclists, and it's based on a survey, essentially, about 76% of the bicyclists in Seattle are white. And of the infractions, of the 1,667, the infractions go to 73% of white people. However, when you look at the black community of cyclists, it represents about 5%. But of the infractions, it represents 17%. And when you look at Asian and Pacific Islanders, they're underrepresented in the tickets. Peyton just had a sense of pride on his face. I saw that. 18% of the Asian population is represented in the bicycling community, and yet they represent only 1.6% of the bicycle helmet infractions. Why is that? So here's what the Times and these activists will have you believe. The folks who are giving out the infractions, the police, and by the way, they do it very infrequently, will have you believe that they are targeting black people because of their racism. They're virulently racist, but not racist against Asians who are underrepresented in the, severely underrepresented in the ticket department. They're only racist against blacks. And I know they list Native Americans and Alaskan Natives here, but it's almost, I mean, there's only 1% separating the demographics and the bicycle helmet infractions. So they see 4.7 to 7.3, 4.7 population of black bicyclists to 17.3% of the infractions. They say that is racism. Or is it possible that there's another reason? Is it possible that those black bicyclists are not wearing a helmet? Is it possible that the homeless individuals who are getting ticketed according to this data happen to be overrepresented by black Washingtonians? And maybe that's where the details are being skewed a little bit? Is that possible? Because why is the Asian number so low? Is it possible, by the way, that the Asian number is so low, lower than the white bicyclists, is because Asian bicyclists wear helmets more than whites? And thus, they are less likely to actually get hit with a ticket? They don't want you to even ask that question or even acknowledge it is a potential answer to these issues. They give it just one sentence in the Seattle Times piece, but that's not what they want your takeaway to be. The takeaway they want is that it is racist and there is disparities in the data. And this is criminalizing behavior. Uh-huh. It's embarrassing. It truly is embarrassing. But that's what the Seattle Times has become, and that's what activism has become here. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. It seems pretty clear that Washington Democrats are pushing us towards an income tax, even though we know it to be unconstitutional. At a time like this, a lot of folks would normally turn to someone like Tim Iman, who has been pretty successful in a lot of his campaigns to get rid of some of these onerous taxes. But where do things stand after he had been hit with some pretty significant penalties for violating campaign finance laws? Tim Iman was fined $2.6 million in a court ruling last week, and there are a lot of consequences to that. Joining us on the line is our friend and activist, Tim Iman. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jason. Appreciate it.
So obviously, you are not going to be happy with a capital gains tax. But before we can get into what it is you're going to be able to do to fight back, where do things stand right now? Is you've been hit with a very substantial fine.
Yeah, that was funny. The judge ended up saying there's a recent Supreme Court ruling says that we can't impose excessive fines. So I'm not going to give the AG the $7 million that he wants. I'm going to only impose $2.6 million. And so in his definition, $2.6 million isn't excessive. I rechecked all my bank accounts, and it's not there. So it almost doesn't matter the dollar amount. They've already taken everything that I have just fighting to actually get to this point with this lawsuit. So obviously this is going to be appealed, and we'll take it to the next level, but that's not going to stop me from going forward with my activism.
What would the appeal look like? Is the appeal that the court made an error in its judgment, or the financial fine that you're hit is the error?
Obviously, it'd be across the board, because as long as you're going to appeal, you might as well go all the way. Richard Sanders, former Supreme Court Justice, is my attorney. He just said this is just has to be appealed. I mean, your restrictions on your free speech, your First Amendment rights, the fine is clearly excessive, violates the Eighth Amendment. But at the end of the day, it's just another fight that I've had. I mean, 22 years they've been trying to stop us because we keep putting these darn ideas on the ballot and the voters keep voting for them. How do we get this guy to stop? And they've hit me with absolutely everything they could over the last 8.5 years. And during that 8.5 years of investigation, litigation, persecution, we've gotten 4 initiatives on the ballot. Voters approved 3 of them. I ran for governor. So I'm not letting this stuff slow me down.
Well, just to go over just briefly some of the claims that they said you are guilty of. They say you secretly funneled campaign donations to personal accounts that you improperly
Stop there. Yeah. Stop there. One at a time, because I think it's really important for each one. For the last 8.5 years, I knew that I was never going to be able to afford to defend myself. Mm-hmm. So I asked supporters to give money to me, to my legal defense fund, so that I could fight back. This judge agreed with the Attorney General that people who made checks payable to Tim Iman or Tim Iman Legal Defense Fund, that was a campaign contribution used for personal use. All I used that money for was to survive this lawsuit. They were never campaign contributions. They were given to me directly. Most important thing that I was accused of is I took campaign contributions. I didn't take anybody's money. People voluntarily sent me money because they saw this injustice and they wanted me to fight back.
So
what was the next one?
Well, is the argument then it wasn't secret? Like, because they argue that it was done in secret, that you were, quote unquote, funneling campaign donations. So you're basically saying, no, I was doing it above board. It was pretty open and honest.
Absolutely. Every person got a letter from me saying the AG is coming after me. Would you please donate money to me so that I can fight back? It was absolutely up front. We had 4 donors testify that we gave them money because we saw this injustice. We wanted to fight back. They ignored the fact that they knew that they weren't giving campaign contributions because they didn't give it to a campaign. They gave it to me, and I used it to fight back against the it's the biggest accusation and the misleading aspect of the lawsuit is that I took campaign contributions. I've been in politics for 22 years. I never took anybody's money. People send me money because they wanted me to be able to survive this thing.
Well, it also says that, and we're talking with Tim Iman, that you were involved in a kickback scheme where one of your campaigns overpaid a signature gathering company, and in turn, they ended up paying you. Did you take money from them?
The signature gathering company absolutely hired me to go get them future clients. And we showed the contract, and we showed the invoice, and we showed that I paid taxes on that money, and I showed that I was able to get them future clients. The AG twisted that into something that it wasn't. Once again, Richard Sanders did a brilliant job highlighting all these various aspects of things that were not true. The judge bought it. But that's one of the reasons why we're appealing it. It's just we fundamentally disagree with this idea that these were campaign funds. These are all monies that were outside of the campaign where I did want to be able to earn money so that I could continue to do my activism. That's absolutely true.
So help me understand. Do you think the judge was fooled into believing what the Attorney General's office was saying? Or do you think that there is some kind of bias against you?
Nothing wrong with both. but briefly, I mean, it was they rubber stamped what the AG did, other than tripling the fine, which was, you know, whatever. It was everything the AG asked for. It might as well have been just a press release by the AG's office in this judge's order. But I mean, he's
they're saying
elected judge.
Yeah, but hold on.
Publicly,
one second, just because I would, obviously they would come back and say to you, and that goes to the point of my question of no, sure. he rubber stamped it because we made our case. We made these allegations and they're all true. So that goes to my point of, you know, is the judge simply going along with it because he believes it and it was a convincing argument and he was fooled, or is there something more sinister at play in your view?
Very clearly, Richard Sanders said there's no way you violated the Campaign Practices Act. Under no circumstances could you possibly have violated any of these things. But at the end of the day, this is a judge that's publicly elected in liberal Thurston County. He was appointed by Gregoire. He rubber stamped what the AG did. The AG went after me, spent more money going after me, spending $8 million of taxpayer money, which is more money than all campaign reporting cases in the last 8 years combined. I mean, they hit me with a full onslaught. And what really buried me, to be honest with you, during that 8 years, there was 9 months where they managed to bully my attorney off the case. And so for 9 months, I was forced to represent myself. And during that 9 months where I didn't know what I was doing, they were able to get a lot of preliminary rulings that Richard Sanders, my attorney, was never able to undo after he came on board.
So why do you think anything would be different by taking this to to the Supreme Court? I mean, you can go ahead and appeal this ultimately all the way up, but you're just going to run into other liberal justices, right?
Well, the one thing that the judge said is that Tim Iman can continue to sponsor initiatives, promote initiatives. He can have a legal defense fund. He just has to basically not involve himself in the financial transactions, which frankly is the way it's been for the last 18 years. But all that will go forward. And so I believe there's a lot of people, and I certainly am one of them, that just don't believe that this ruling jives with the facts of the case or people's rights under the Constitution. I mean, one of the weirdest things this judge said, which he agreed with the AG on, is that Tim Iman personally is a political committee and therefore must report as an entity, but since I'm not allowed to participate in the decisions related to a political committee, I can't participate in decisions about myself. It was just the strangest, weirdest thing the AG asked for, but the judge went along with it, and Sanders just said, you're the first person in human history that's ever been declared a political action committee, Tim, so I don't know what to tell you. We just got to appeal this, and I agree. I think we should.
Okay, so corporations aren't people, according to the left, but people are PACs, I guess. So that's kind of
not people, just Tim Iman.
Yeah,
just so it's timdefense.com if people want to help me appeal this thing. I think it's insane. I think it's nuts. But I'm going full steam ahead with a no income tax initiative and a no carbon tax initiative because, as you pointed out at the outset, Dems on Wednesday passed the capital gains tax out of committee. They seem heck bent to go forward with that, and I think at the end of the day we've got to fight back, and the only way I've seen that's effective way to fight back is with citizen initiatives letting the voters vote on them.
Yes, until the courts get involved or they're just ignored in the state legislature. Let's actually continue this conversation on the other side of the break, because it is really important since there are so many issues not just having to do with taxes that very clearly are going against the will of the people, but policing and other issues. So we're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. That's Tim Iman. You're listening to the Jason Rand Show. To the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH, continuing our conversation with activist Tim Iman, who is moving forward with his activism despite a significant court loss, but he is pushing forward, he is appealing, and in the meantime, Tim, you're pushing back against inevitability that we are headed towards an income tax here, starting with a capital gains tax. That's not going to be the end. They're debating the wealth tax. We're going to get hit with a gas tax. So, you know, we were talking in the last segment, these voter initiatives, they tend to be successful. Not always, but they tend to be successful until they're not successful, until a judge decides to toss them or the state legislature just completely ignores them and moves forward with legislation. So are we at the point where, beyond sending a message, that really the only thing that's going to ultimately change things is just getting better people in office?
That's always a part of the equation. It always is. But as long as we're stuck with these particular people, you have to have a collective voice of the people saying what they're doing is wrong. And there's certainly ways to do that. I mean, I'm testifying on various bills, and I'm having our supporters do that. We're having emails going out to all 147 legislators. But getting an idea like prohibiting any kind of income tax at the state and local level is the way to emphatically send that message. And I do believe that if you're careful enough, if you walk the tightrope, and I've learned over the last 22 years what works and what doesn't, and I'm not perfect. I mean, I put $500,000 of my own money into the $30 tabs initiative because we sold off our retirement fund and we loaned that much money to that initiative. I was that confident that there's no way the court could possibly strike that one down. Yet they struck it down anyway because they said the AG's ballot title that he wrote for that initiative was misleading. I obviously think that's insane, but you learn from that experience and you move forward with it. Prohibiting any kind of state and income, state or local income tax, the thing that's attractive about that is there's plenty of precedents on the books about certain taxes being prohibited. The sales tax on food, plenty of precedent for that. This is something that is already, in theory, prohibited by the Constitution, but unfortunately, this Supreme Court seems to be able to make up rules like no other, and they put it enough stuff into the bill, substitute Senate Bill 1596, that gives the court just enough cover to be able to authorize it. But an initiative like this one would prohibit it and be able to say, the court said you can have one, but we're allowed to prohibit that if we want to with a citizen initiative. It's a matter of fighting back. For 22 years, I've fought back with initiatives. They've saved taxpayers $46 billion over that period of time, lower car tabs, lower property taxes, but it was clearly a bumpy road along the way because we were always fighting against liberals controlling the courts, the House, the Senate, the governor's mansion. Imagine, you know, how much we've been able to accomplish despite all those things.
So what would then be just the argument?
Sure.
Because I hear you still on the initiatives, and yet I do have in the back of my mind the concerns. What is it? What would be the argument against just getting more involved on the campaign side and going after certain seats? Because you obviously have in both the House and the Senate some vulnerable Democrats that could be defeated, and defending some of the more vulnerable Republicans. I mean, you know, you go into the Steve O'Bannon race in the state Senate. He loses to a Seattle style
300 votes.
Yeah, so
300 votes, brutal.
A lot of support and money there, and activism there could go a really long way. And this conversation is completely different when it comes to the capital gains tax, because we do have some Democrats who are saying no to the capital gains tax. We have at least two.
Yes. And I think the important thing is that's election time. That's 2022. That's 2 years from now. What do you do from now till then? You know, I believe that with citizen initiatives, you actually help those candidates by illustrating that the voters are against these kinds of ideas, and so therefore you help all of them. I'm not saying people shouldn't work on candidate campaigns. I'm just saying that I do initiatives, put ideas on the ballot, the voters vote on them, and they have a tremendous impact. And they really can't deny the amount of effectiveness we had, because if I wasn't being effective, they wouldn't be coming after me all the time. I mean, the reality is if I was so ineffective, they'd just leave me alone. The reason is that we just keep coming back again and again and again is that this is truly the passion of my life. I mean, this entire process has taken everything I've ever had. Chances are, they'll end up taking our house. I've already lost everything. But I'm still moving forward with this thing because I'm simply not going to let them take me down. Because if they take me down, you could be next, somebody else could be next. And I believe that this is the reason I was essentially put on this earth, is to be a political activist, to put ideas out there. And at the end of the day, they can't stop me from trying. The only thing they can do is try and deter other people from helping me be able to succeed. And for 22 years, a lot of people have stuck with me, and I just feel I owe it to those people to keep trying.
So we only have about 2 minutes left. Let's just wrap this up in talking about the impact this is going to have, not just on what you do moving forward, but the way you do it. I mean, obviously, people do recognize your name, certainly on the west side of the state, a little bit more than the east side, but here, people are following this case, and they now know you've been hit with this judgment, and you're not going to be able to escape that, and you're not going to be able to make the appeal you just did about why the system did not work the way it was supposed to every individual who otherwise would say, hey, I like that idea, but I don't necessarily trust now the brand of Tim Iman because of the news. So how do you overcome that?
Well, I think first things first. I mean, I could move to Idaho and sell real estate for a living, and I'd probably do great at that. But that's not what I want to do. I want to continue to put these ideas out there because I believe in them. So step one is not throwing up your hands and giving up, is by sticking with it. The second point I think is very important is I'm not just going to accept this ruling. I'm going to appeal it because I think it's just so insane that one person is a political committee, that people that voluntarily send you money is a campaign contribution if you use the money only to defend yourself from the state going after you. And what it really boils down to more than anything else, it has to be the idea, and it has to be how over the top the legislature has gone. If anything, Wednesday, it was like the Democrats saying, what can we do to resurrect Tim Iman? Let's pass a capital gains income tax, which is clearly a Pandora's box that once it's imposed on some of us, it will be imposed on all of us. That, those kind of actions, I don't want them to take those actions. I want them to be reasonable. But if they're going to go crazy, I think it's absolutely essential that somebody step forward and do it. And most people aren't so masochistic that they're willing to put themselves in that mosh pit of politics, especially initiative politics, because they know what happens to people that get into that.
Well, if you guys want to help, timdefense.com is the name of the website, timdefense.com. Tim Iman, as always, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. And people want to help the initiatives, more important, permanentoffense.com, permanentoffense.com.
There you go, permanentoffense.com. Thank you so much for stopping by, Tim.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. You are listening to The Jason Rantz Show. Back with two more hours after this.